Coming up on the Radio Today programme this week, Trevor Dan talks to Professor David Hendy about the latest interactive website launched as part of the 100 Voices That Made the BBC project. James Cridlin will put forward the case for more rethinking and reinventing in radio. And David Lloyd has our usual trip down memory lane with some radio moments.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
That's all to come here on the Radio Today programme. First, though, as ever, we start with a chat with Radio Today's founder and editor, Roy Martin, who joins us on the line.
Oh, you could pretend that we're in the same room, surely.
Okay, we're in the same room. That's
like
a nice
in the
t-shirt
Radio Today
you've got.
Virtual office. Nice hair.
Put your shorts back on. It's not that warm.
Thank you. It's hot. It's sweltering. I wish it would rain, to be honest with you.
So what's been going on in radio this week? We're going to talk about that in a moment, but there's a special birthday going on. As we record this, our old friend Derek, who used to do the breakfast show on 2BR, is back on air after 18 years there.
Oh, yes, 2BR. Happy birthday. 25th of July, 2000. Yeah, so happy birthday, 2BR. They're playing the old jingles, which, of course, every station does if they're doing a birthday thing. But they were recorded by, if I remember correctly, Steve England. They had packages from Bespoke and TM. But yeah, they're bringing back the oldies. And Derek Webster's on air from 10 till 2 on the 18th birthday.
And how do those jingles sound?
99.8 FM. 2BR.
Like that.
There we go.
Well, yeah. This was a special place for me and Roy because we didn't meet at 2BR, but we worked together at 2BR, didn't we? Which is going back a long
we
time.
We did, yeah. When you joined, when did you join?
2002.
Oh, right, okay. And we met at the B, didn't we? Just before that, on one of the RSLs.
Yeah, 2001.
Wow.
And we've raided our old hard drives for 2BR jingles and things this morning, and I stumbled across this randomly.
The best music and more for Burnley, Hindburn and Pendle. This is 99.8 FM, 2BR.
It's Foxy.
Wow. It's Foxy. That's when he had the wonderful job of recording a news intro or drops for every single station which took the Pepsi chart. That must have been a ball ache.
Just a bit. But happy birthday, 2BR. Lots of happy memories. And the old building where we used to work, it's a nursery now. My daughter used to go there.
Oh, wow. Well, it was always full of kids. So
prima donnas.
That's very appropriate.
Right, so let's get on with some of the other news this week. And the big talking point back end of last week was Radio 1's Hide and Seek. It was gripping, wasn't it?
I love this. I was always a big fan of the old fugitive and renegade kind of mechanic that commercial radio did. Quite often, about 10, 20 years ago. It just smelled of that. And it was really good because we didn't know where they were. We had a clue of a chair that Grimmy was sat in. There was a Costa and a Nando's nearby. That could be anywhere. But we all got the clues together. I thought it was Leeds at one point, but it turned out to be Liverpool, but it was great radio.
And this is the country's biggest ever game of hide and seek.
Greg James and Nick Grimshaw.
What?
Broadcasting live from a secret location.
It's Annie Mack here reporting for Judy. My show has been taken over by a harebrained idea of Greg James and Grimmies.
I can see a Costa. I can see a Subway.
This is classic middle-sized town vibes. Always a Costa, a Pizza Express.
No. This is city.
On the other side, there is a little blue car. And to the left of you, it's just you and a big, big blue lorry with the word tile on it.
Kel?
Yes?
We're not in there.
They've been gone for 17 hours and the whole of the UK and all the Radio 1 DJs haven't been able to find them.
I'm in a car on the way to Birmingham to try and find Greg and Grimmy.
Dev, you're in completely the wrong place.
Oh my!
Oh. All evidence points towards the Liver building in Liverpool.
Yes!
What? What?
No way!
Hang on.
Woo! Yes!
Faye!
Ring the gong!
Ring the gong!
Yes!
Oh, it was good, and I think I've listened to Radio 1 more in the last week than I've listened to in the last year, so that tells you something as well, doesn't it? And I thought Scott Mills did a great job of the tease in that last 20 minutes as they knew they were getting close. It was good listening. And a fitting end as well for Greg's time on Drive Time, because he's finished for the summer now and he's starting on Breakfast in September, but we don't know exactly when yet, I don't think, Roy.
We don't know, and I think he's gone on holiday, judging by his Instagram photos. So having a bit of a break and then back in the autumn, maybe in a couple of months, I'd say.
And a new show, and it's Chris Smith with the news, won't be doing the news with him in Breakfast, and a few people are a bit upset about that, but there we are.
Yeah, there's a campaign, isn't there? One of these stupid campaigns that never work. We keep getting emails saying, why aren't you talking about this? Well, you know, newsreaders and presenters get separated every day. We'd be a bit busy if we wrote about all of them, wouldn't we?
We would. Richard Bacon was back on Five Live this week. Of course, he's not been very well. He was in an induced coma for more than a week. And he spoke to Colin Paterson on Five Live's afternoon edition earlier this week.
And I came round and it's a room of strangers. And I'd had all these weird drugs, and I was hallucinogenic drugs, and I was frightened, and I was really kicking off. I mean, I was actually kicking off, like, to the point where they had to restrain me, kicking and...
Because you were so confused?
I was confused and I was frightened. And in the end, they put me back under, and they brought me out again a second time, more slowly, 2 days later, which was much more effective, just much more gentle. But I was very, very confused to start with. Coming out was the worst day of my life.
That's Richard Bacon, and we wish him every continued success in his recovery as that continues. John Motson, we thought he'd retired from the BBC. He's been doing some commentaries for Five Live over the last couple of years, as well as working on Match of the Day. But he's coming back with Talk Sport. Good signing for them.
Yes, indeed. It just got me... It's funny how people are negative about anything. A guy coming out of retirement has been doing what he was doing for, what, 30, 40, 50 years?
50 years, yeah.
50 years. And he's obviously getting a bit bored in his retirement. He's had a good offer from commercial radio. So he comes back and does a bit for commercial radio. And people are writing horrible comments about it. Why does anybody find anything negative about something, a guy getting a job? Absolutely crazy. Why can't people just be happy?
I tell you what, this will make you happy. What, do you want to work Christmas this year?
Do I want to work Christmas?
It's six months away.
It's July, for goodness sake.
So Paul Sylvester at Absolute Radio apparently has sent an email round asking what shows people will do at Christmas. He wants Leona Graham to work New Year's Day 2019. And she's tweeted and thinks this kind of discussion should be banned until October or November.
He's having a bit of trouble, is Paul Sylvester. There was another email that made it onto social media, wasn't it?
Yes.
A couple of days ago.
The message he sent to the marketing team saying, these are the key messages, can we push these on socials? And they just screen grabbed it and tweeted it from the Absolute Radio account.
That's right, yeah. Why not?
Gets a bit of publicity, though. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
So if Paul's struggling to fill his schedule, we'll do Christmas Day. Yeah, we'll do it on IPDTL like this.
The Roy and Stu show?
Yeah, I'm up for that.
Or is it the Stu and Roy show?
Bring back Russ and Jono, that's what I say. Oh, they're coming back.
Yeah, well, they might be. Well, they are in a podcast.
Yeah, there'll be a lot of people looking forward to that. And I see as well that Russ is making a return this weekend to the radio. At the time of us speaking, he hasn't announced where, but apparently he's doing a show on Saturday.
Shall we try and guess?
Go on.
Or will we be totally off the mark? Is it going to be sports kind of station, or is it going
to
be...
Well, he's done that before, hasn't he? He did the sports show on LBC 1152. He did the sports stuff on Absolute Radio on a Saturday afternoon.
Well, maybe Love Sport, because they've got a random bunch of people on there, haven't they?
There's Love Sport, there's Talk Sport, there's BBC, BBC Local Radio. Lots of places.
Could be anywhere. Well, we'll find out, I'm sure. Keep an eye on his Twitter, RussW777 or something like that.
That's the one. And Radio News Hub, 1 million bulletins dispatched.
Yeah, this is quite good for the little guy, really, because Radio News Hub was set up by a few journalists, and they wanted to provide basically an alternative to the Dominator, which is IRN. And a lot of people thought it would fail. So 4 years later, 1 million bulletins, still going strong. And they're on over 200 radio stations, which is something to celebrate, I would say.
Thank you, Roy. Enjoy the rest of your week in radio, in the sunshine. And
Bring me some rain, please. I want some rain.
Phone calls, social media, SMS, email, codec control and visualization through the same interface. Phone box from Broadcast Bionics. Welcome to the social studio at bionics.co.uk.
Now, David Lloyd's isn't the only archive collection we're going to be dipping into on the podcast this week. The BBC's just released the fourth in its series of interactive websites called 100 Voices That Made the BBC. And this latest one is dedicated to the story of the BBC in the multicultural years that began with the arrival of the Empire Windrush 70 years ago. It's been curated with the University of Sussex, and Professor David Hendy, who led the project, has been speaking to Trevor Dan.
The BBC has to be thought of as not just a collection of radio stations or television channels. It's a cultural, political institution which has been at the centre of British life. And although we know quite a bit about the BBC, we've all got an extraordinary set of personal memories about radio programmes we've listened to as we've grown up and TV programmes we've watched. And if you're an academic researcher like me, you can go to the BBC's Written Archive Centre and you can see all the internal documents. We've got all that, but there is a missing bit of the jigsaw. And that missing bit of the jigsaw is that the BBC, for the last few decades, has been accumulating its own in-house set of recorded interviews with key members of staff. Now, that started in 1972 when the BBC was celebrating its 50th birthday. And they realised that that founding generation of people who'd set up the BBC and worked in it since the 1920s and through the war and so on was actually about to die, and that they had a lot of important personal memories of working at the BBC locked up in their minds. Now, those recorded interviews have been inside the BBC, and this project really is about trying to bring them out into the public realm. That's not actually a straightforward task because there are about nearly 700 of them, some of them on cassette, some of them on reel-to-reel, some of them on 16mm film, some of them transcribed, not all of them. So it's a kind of very unwieldy collection, and it's actually quite a slow and painful process to try and make this into a unified, searchable collection which actually will be of benefit to a wide number of people.
We know that the BBC is pretty good at finding out other people's secrets, but you and I have both worked for it a few years ago, and we know how secretive it can be about itself.
Yes.
Have you been encouraged during your life as an academic to go in and tell the full story, or are there still places they don't want you to go?
I've been encouraged, and it was indeed the BBC that approached me about this collection being put into the public realm. On the other hand, of course, the BBC is properly worried about its reputation. And one of the challenges for the BBC is that obviously these oral history interviews, they were interviews recorded with senior members of staff, presenters, managers, editors, at the point when they just left the BBC or retired from the BBC, and they were encouraged to speak openly and frankly about their time at the BBC. So yes, they are a set of frank, open interviews. But I think the value of them isn't so much that they reveal all sorts of sort of dark secrets about the BBC, but they help you to understand the way in which the BBC has been made by people. We tend to think of it as a sort of a big institution with policies and structures and editorial guidelines and so on. But it's actually an institution which has been forged by the people who work for it. And so that kind of personal, subjective, ringside account of working at the BBC is what really fleshes out the emotions, the passions, the hopes, the fears, the anxieties, all that kind of emotional dimension to the history of the BBC that actually really gets you to understand why certain things were done, why people felt passionate about creating radio of a certain kind at a certain point in its history.
Now, the latest release in this series, 100 Voices That Made the BBC, is called People, Nation and Empire, and you've published it to coincide clearly with the 70th anniversary of Windrush. There is in here not just interviews with former members of the BBC, but with people recorded contemporaneously. And there's a lot of television as well, but there's some radio that was I'm trying to say, listening to with modern ears, some of this is quite difficult, isn't it?
It is difficult, and this is one of the challenges. If you're an academic media historian like me, trying to speak to a wider audience and trying to say, look, this is interesting, and this is why it's interesting, then you kind of need to handle this material carefully. The oral history interviews can be a bit insiderish. I mean, you know, a lot of the interviews consisted of Frank Gillard, a great figure in BBC radio history, talking to people who were previously his colleagues. And so the tone is a little bit insiderish, and certain phrases and bits of jargon are thrown around and so on. These interviews don't necessarily explain themselves. So they need a bit of context. They need a bit of explanation. The other thing, of course, is that not everyone that you wish had been interviewed was interviewed. If you're trying to tell the story of the BBC trying to get to grips with the multicultural nature of Britain, then what you're also dealing with here in this collection is a very large number of dead white males. And you don't really get that sense of a variety of perspectives. And so there's going to be a sort of imbalance in the story that you can tell unless you start to also draw in some examples from the programme archives. And also to speak to people who are still alive today who might well have a very strong and clear memory and have the power of perspective and to add some new insights into what happened in the past. We have, for instance, recorded an extended interview with Mike Phillips, who worked at the BBC in the 70s and the 80s, partly at Bush House, partly in local radio, partly in education. And he was one of the few black producers and journalists at the BBC at a time when the BBC was, to re-quote Greg Dyke, hideously white. So his experience of working at the BBC on programmes that were designed to cover Caribbean issues, for instance, to cover local issues in Manchester in the 1970s, that's the kind of testimony that is actually really, really valuable to add into the mix.
And you've included some extraordinary stuff, like there's some documents, but also some interviews about why the black and white minstrel show was still being shown on the television as late as 1978. And you've got, again, this is a television thing, but you've got a very early edition, I think it may be the first episode, of Make Yourself at Home, which was the BBC television programme for, quote, Asian immigrants, unquote. That's an extraordinary piece that seems to come from hundreds of years ago, not just a few decades.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, it's a challenge, isn't it, looking at this material and trying to get a sense of whether or not it ever felt fresh and different, because it can't help but seem archaic. But even so, I think this is what we're trying to do with this 100 Voices project, is to say, look, don't look at the programmes in isolation. Don't look at the interviews in isolation. But if you pull together the interviews about what's going on behind the scenes, if you look at the programme archives, if you look at some of the written evidence, if you catch up with some of the people now who were involved then, if you pull that evidence together, you can start to see something like that programme, Make Yourself at Home, in the round. And you can start to get a sense of why it was as it was. And actually, what's really interesting about Make Yourself at Home is that the BBC really was quite reluctant at first to do programmes for, quote, immigrants in 1965. Its intuitive bias, I think, in the BBC is to try to be, to not draw attention to difference. In other words, it's this organisation founded in the years just after the First World War, which is really drawn to the idea of kind of uniting the nation or healing the nation. And programmes for immigrants were one of those things that seemed to be kind of drawing attention to difference in some way. And the BBC was uncomfortable with it. Hugh Carton Green, the Director General at the time, a great progressive figure, was, you can tell from the documents that we've published through this project, he's uncomfortable about the notion of a series like Make Yourself at Home. And in many ways, that's the wonderful thing about the BBC, is that even though they were uncomfortable with it, they do it. And when they do it, they kind of have a go at doing it properly and taking it seriously. And, you know, there's a 35-page document, which we've got on the 100 Voices website, where they're reflecting inside the BBC on, you know, what are the strengths and weaknesses of this series? What have we got right? What have we got wrong? And in a way, this is quite wonderful to behold, because it gives you a sense of the BBC. It might get it wrong, it might get it right, but it's always asking itself that question, have we got it right? It's always thinking things through.
One final thought, David. It seemed to me when I was playing with it, and it is a very interactive experience, that this is feeling its way towards a new way of telling history. You know, we know what a radio documentary is, we know what a television documentary is, we know what a website is, and obviously there's a lot of text in that, and that's a bit like a book on a screen. This is almost something new. This is like being able to sit down with the actual archives and search them yourself and go off on little journeys and come back and look at a picture and read some text and see some commentary written by you or one of your colleagues. It's, I hate to use that buzzword, immersive, but it's a really interesting way of plonking yourself right in the middle of a story rather than sitting back and letting somebody tell it to you.
Yeah, well, I'm really pleased that's what you think, and I have no objection whatsoever to you using the word immersive. I mean, you have to do things differently if you're doing it online. And I suppose the other thing to say is that the reason that we at the University of Sussex are involved in this project is because I'm based in a part of the university called the Sussex Humanities Lab. And it's a place where we are trying to explore the different ways of actually presenting archival material. A few years ago, I think what people thought of as digitization was you'd get a set of documents, whether they were written or they were oral or video or whatever, and you'd sort of digitize them and you'd scan them and then you just sort of somehow make them available. Well, we think there's actually something a bit more interesting that you can do with that. We're trying to get the material out as we find it. So it's part of that belief in trying to kind of publish as you go rather than wait years and years and years, so that you make material as available as soon as you can. The other part of the project, which is less visible, is to slowly try and build a kind of catalogue of all of these interviews to make them really, really richly searchable, and that you can play with them. And actually, you know, that playfulness is quite important. Let me just sort of take one example. You've got nearly 700 interviews, all transcribed eventually and many, many pages long. And you can link that transcript with the actual recording so that you could search a word and you could find that word when it's uttered on the recording. You could then get some digital tool and you can start playing with visualizations and mapping themes and searching for ideas like the use of language, for instance. Just take the words that we've got for this website, people, nation, empire. You could, for instance, have a digital tool that searches for the use of those words across the entire collection. Do people talk about empire less? Do people talk about people more than nation? What was the crossover point? Some of these big patterns can be revealed once you start to kind of digitize something. So it's not just that an interview becomes available, but that you can start to explore big data questions as well. You can start to spot patterns that you wouldn't be able to even think about looking for until you digitize this. So I suppose ultimately what I'm saying is we don't yet know what this will end up like. 100 voices that made the BBC in 2 or 3 years' time might be very different. I mean, we've got 4 more editions of this to do, so watch this space.
If you want to watch the space, go to bbc.co.uk/history of the BBC, and this latest iteration is at /people www.radio-nation-empire. Professor David Hendy from the University of Sussex, thanks very much for coming on the Radio Today programme.
Thank you.
That's Professor David Hendy talking to Trevor Dann. And David, by the way, wrote an excellent book about BBC Radio 4 a few years ago. Worth looking up that one. Just before we go to James Cridland, a little word about Clean Feed if you've not heard about it. If you're doing OBs, doing remote interviews, or co-hosting a show from somewhere different to the studio, Clean Feed could help you out. It's designed for radio and for podcasters. It's really simple to connect live audio over the web. The quality is great. You can record as well, and they just launched some new pro features this week. Clean Feed doesn't cost anything to get started. It'll only take you 30 seconds to sign up, and you could be doing your first live interview, your first recording, your first remote show from the pub within a few minutes. You can find out more at cleanfeed.net. That's cleanfeed.net.
From Philadelphia for the Podcast Movement Conference, I'm James Cridland, the radio futurologist. Two stories last week made me think. First, an off-the-cuff tweet from a radio station in Scotland having a day of going retro by playing CDs. How quaint. Now, I shared this in a Facebook group, and it wasn't too long before the comments descended into Monty Python's Yorkshireman sketch. Retro? I'll give you retro, said one, before talking about queuing up 45s. Oh, blimey, 45s, you had it easy, said somebody else, discussing editing on Reel to Reel. Now, I remember my first full-time radio gig, doing afternoon drive at the Pulse in Bradford. And during a typical hour, I'd be playing a mixture of CDs and 45s. I'd be filling in full PRS returns, including record companies and catalogue numbers. Each of those songs needed the level setting and queuing to a suitable point. Every segue was, of course, live. Selecting the right jingle or sweeper was up to me. And I'd be running to the fax machine outside the studio, where the AA would send over barely legible hieroglyphics about travel issues, which I would have to blind read on air. The ads would be on individual carts, which all needed fetching and putting away at the back of the studio. My news was at a clock start at the top of the hour. Without a producer, I also needed to answer telephone calls and run contests myself. And somewhere in the midst of all of this, I had to somehow work out something cogent to say. Now, you can sometimes understand the viewpoint of the former presenters in this group, who mostly appear to be driving trains, it seems, that radio isn't what it once was. And radio isn't what it once was. When the music and the ad breaks are all available at the push of a next button, you can concentrate on other things, and the output should be, and almost invariably is, rather better. The other piece of news was a piece of work by BBC News Labs, and they're doing some rethinking and prototyping online news story formats. It's a good piece of work, informed by data. And it suddenly struck me that much of the structure of radio hasn't changed from the days of 45s and carts. We only got network news at the top of the hour 20 years ago, so that's when we needed to take it. But many of us still break for news at the top of the hour now, even if there's no technical need for that anymore. And plenty of evidence that news consumption is changing away from a cram as much as you can news bulletin. We've moved away from carts, but we're still selling 30-second ads, clumping advertising stop sets together, and shoving many of them to the back of the hour for some bizarre reason. And if you don't understand why it's a bizarre reason, try setting your alarm clock to 6:45 in the morning to discover how dreadful it sounds to a typical radio listener, which is all I am these days. And there are plenty more things that we do in radio that haven't changed in 30 years. A horrible old news jingle, because tradition. Using call signs rather than a sensible brand. And the utter pointlessness of travel news. Now, I love the idea of rethinking things. And most of the time, that process reveals that it's always done that way for a reason. Some of the time, though, it hits on something new. So maybe we should do more of it, don't you think? You can get my weekly newsletter at james.crid.land and at daily podcast news at podnews.net. And until next time, keep listening. And now on the Radio Today programme, here's David Lloyd. You and David Lloyd,
Radio Moment. It's 45 years since the most exciting days of summer began for UK teenagers. Back then, there wasn't a lot else to do. So how excited were we when the Radio 1 Roadshow came to town?
From St. George's Park in York.
I daren't repeat where it's coming from. It is, of course, in that place. Dear me, you only have to say that place and they're off here.
the Radio 1 Hot Show.
Today, live from the Piggy Pool Arena, Bangor, with Simon Bates.
Way to start the Radio Road Roadshow. It's 7:30 past 11 and the sunshine in Bangor. Let me tell you a few things. First of all, if you don't know Northern Ireland, what I want you to do is visualise a map of Great Britain.
Boom, 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 let me hear you say mayo. Mayo. Boom, 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 let me hear you say mayo. Mayo.
97 to 99 FM, the Radio 1 Roadshow. Live from Greensword, Clacton-on-Sea with Simon Mayo.
Welcome to the Roadshow 1996. We'll leave behind the floaters and the drifters. And we're here in Clacton-on-Sea. Hello, good morning.
My name is Michael Blaine. I'm 11 years old. Welcome to the Radio 1 Roadshow from Seaton Carew.
The art of mixing those screams and those jingles. The Radio 1 Roadshow, an idea from the man who would be controller, Johnny Beerling.
I was on holiday down in France and I saw these French campers taking their aluminium chairs after their evening meal. And I thought, oh, I'll follow them, what are they doing? And they were sitting in front of a big caravan. I think it was either Radio Monte Carlo or Radio Luxembourg, I don't know. But they had this big sort of caravan with a side that opened and a stage. And they're doing a programme which I can only compare to Sunday night at the London Palladium on the radio. And I thought if we could have a show that we could travel around the beaches and do it, that would be quite successful. And so I came back and floated the idea to Derek Chinnery. And I started to make inquiries within the BBC and nobody had such a vehicle. So we had a meeting of producers, and the producer from the BBC in Bristol was a chap called Brian Patton. And Brian said, I know a man who's John Miles. He's the manager of Ad Cutler and the Wurzels, and he's got a Pantechnicon, a side that opens, and they do it at country fairs. They do that, ooh-ah-ooh-ah. I said, oh, we'll go and see John then. Literally sketched out on a cigarette packet almost in John's living room.
At a time when commercial radio competition was about to arrive, it was a good time to be seen around the UK and prove just how national Radio 1 was across its various nations and how well it understood its large patch.
Yesterday we came from Newcastle, we came through Ballinahinch, through Ballygowan, Cooma and also Newtownards, and today, am I pronouncing it wrong again? The man can't even do his own research properly.
And it was a good time, too, to air some accents rarely heard on the BBC back then.
Let's go to our next guy here. If it's a guy or a girl, I don't know. Hello.
Paul Conway from Scotland.
Oh, hello, Paul. How are you?
Fine.
What part of Scotland are you from?
Just outside Edinburgh.
You got a great voice. How many miles do you think we've done?
29.
29. All right, let's find out.
Steve Wright on the Radio 1 Roadshow this week in 1973. If Radio 1 was trying to reach out more locally, the new commercial radio network in time moved in the opposite direction with more network programming. One of the earliest offerings was The Chart Show, originally called The Network Chart. Kid Jensen launched it, and his final edition was this week, 25 years ago.
Is the network chart with the sounds that rain down all over Britain via the SMS satellite. And for the last time on the network chart, this is Kid Jensen, turning up the heat for the beat with the hottest top 40 in the UK. And from the corridors in the Gallery of the Greats, we hear a network chart nugget from Europe.
Kid Jensen had his last network chart. The programme then became the Pepsi chart with Pat Sharp, then Hit 40 UK. And now, of course, the Big Top 40 show. In those days, it competed directly against the BBC chart. Now, of course, it doesn't. And these days, local commercial radio as a whole in that day part attracts around a quarter of all UK listening. Radio 1 has just a 5% share. We mentioned last week the drama of Kenny Everett's sacking, which did mean an opening for a new voice at Radio 1. Hotfoot from the Trails Department.
Thank you very much indeed, Sean Kelly.
Lou Edmonds, Lou Edmonds,
the wonderful Radio 1.
And a very good morning to John Robinson. John Robinson, I'll repeat that once more. John Robinson, you see, he's gone away, and unfortunately I've mucked it all up because I was meant to send greetings to him from Jan of Liverpool, but he's gone away. Jan doesn't know where he is, but John, if you're listening this morning, Jan of Liverpool sends lots of love to you and hopes you'll be home very soon. The reason I know all about that particular thing is because I was doing a Radio 1 Club on Tuesday from Liverpool, from the Grafton Rooms, in fact, or the Grafton Rooms, as I preferred to say, but when I said it to the taxi driver, he says, "You are, Wack, you are. You mean the Grafton Rooms, don't you?"
The excellent early days of Noel Edmonds on Radio 1. In due course, he was to end up, of course, on The Breakfast Show. He left in 1983. And then 20 years later, this week, he returned for a brief spell on Radio 2.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Drive Time. I'm Noel Edmonds, and I'm really delighted to be here. But I'm extremely unhappy about the circumstances, obviously. I wish Johnny well with a really speedy and successful conclusion to his treatment. He'll be back in October, so you've got me for 8 weeks through August and September. Please be gentle. I've not done anything like this for a while.
Noel Edmonds filling in on Radio 2 Drive during Johnny Walker's illness 15 years ago. So with North Sound launching in Aberdeen 37 years ago...
We're Britain's 27th independent radio station and we're broadcasting to northeast Scotland from our studios in Kingsgate, Aberdeen.
Radio North Sea International being jammed 48 years ago...
No free Western country has ever jammed a free broadcasting station, even in times of war.
LBC on strike 40 years ago...
Owing to an industrial dispute, normal services on both LBC and Independent Radio News have been suspended for the time being.
And Tony Blackburn joining Radio Caroline South, his first ever station, 54 years ago.
And you'll hear the best around like this one. The number 16 sound from Graham Bonney, Fabrica, called Supergirl, 22 minutes past 7.
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Thank you, David. Thanks also to James, to Trevor and guest David Hendy, and to Radio Today's Roy Martin. We'll be back again with another podcast next week.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.